morning. Hawaii is part of the National 100,000 Homes Campaign. We'll talk with State Homelessness Coordinator Colin Kipman about Hawaii's place in the four-year-old initiative and about some of the more subtle ways we talk about homeless people that shows our real attitudes toward them. And the leader of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is in Honolulu this week. We'll look at the message Max Richmond has for Hawaii. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Also this hour, we'll talk with a Hawaii Island woman who says she healed herself through art. Some of it's going on display on Maui. Later, Gordon Freitas will give us a preview of a peace concert. It's Thursday, May 29th from HPR2. It's The Conversation, and here's the news.
Loi, 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 boa. Joey, 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 Joey. Mo and Joe run the candy store, telling fortunes behind the door. The cops grab Mo, and as Joe run out, Brother Mo, he began to shout, run, Joe, hey, the man's at the door, run, Joe. The man, he won't let me go, run, Joe. Run, Joe, as fast as you can, run, Joe. This police holding me hand.
And we just heard the voice of Maya Angelou. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
All too many signs that we find it easy to harden our hearts toward the homeless, yeah?
In some sectors, yes, and in others, maybe not. We're going to talk about that this morning in our first conversation. Now, on Monday, you may have seen that small piece in the Honolulu Star Advertiser about the Waikiki Beach that's now on Dr. Beach's list. The piece, titled No Ifs, Ands, or Buts, seems fine until that last sentence, now about those Waikiki homeless encampments. That, according to Disappeared News editor Larry Geller, shows our real attitude toward homeless people. And on this program, Geller went on to say that despite the work of State Homeless Coordinator Colin Kipman, a lack of staff and real data similar to the study recently completed in Orlando meant more talk than action for Hawaii's homeless. So we called Colin Kipman. He joins us this morning. Thanks for being here.
Aloha, Beth Ann.
I want to talk to you first about that little piece that we all saw on Monday of looking at the idea that the beach was on this list because there was a lack of litter, all these great things about it. And then that last kicker sentence, which seems to dehumanize people who are homeless for whatever reason and bring in the idea that somehow they should be swept away like the rest of the litter.
Our idea really is that we need to do something to help those people who are homeless. It's a situation that exists across the United States. It also exists here. And the reality is that, especially here in Hawaii, where the cost of living is so high, there are many, many of us who are several paychecks away from the streets. If something were to occur, if a relationship were to break up, if we were to lose a job, if any of a number of events could occur, if we were, you know, suffering from some mental or health issue, the list goes on. You know, we would find ourselves at jeopardy for being homeless. And our intention is to create a response to that that, you know, quickly gets people off the streets and into homes.
Does that, though, become thwarted by attitudes like what we saw in that little blurb on Monday, that somehow we aren't really all there on the same page with you as you're trying to do what you've been doing for the last several years?
You know, I think people have different ideas about the subject. I think that one of the big issues is to understand who the homeless people are. And the reality is that they're not one demographic. They are our neighbors. They are our friends. They may be our family members. You know, all of this is the reality of homelessness. And I think that it's important that we understand who the homeless are. And that is exactly one of the things that I'm trying to do in the work that I'm engaged in, is to create a situation where we understand who homeless people are.
We've had several national folks here in recent months, and they all seem to be telling us that we need to look at this issue very differently and really understand who, as you say, who these people really are, and put them into, I don't want to say put them into buckets, but be able to segment them into categories so we know how to best serve them. But that first goes into knowing who they really are. That's part and parcel of the 100,000 Homes campaign,
right,
where the issue is you've got to know these people by name, which
right.
means you have to be on the street, talk to them, at least those who you can really talk to, and understand who those most needy people are and not look at neediness or worthiness instead of neediness.
Yeah, and you know, the 100,000 Homes campaign was about a year and a half ago, and we participated in it, but government wasn't a primary actor. We did not want to have government involved in it because we thought that we need a new approach. And the idea behind 100,000 Homes is to assess those individuals and to determine who are the neediest individuals. And in our community, we said we want to house the 100 neediest individuals. But of course, in order to do that, we have to figure out what our scale is as to who the homeless are, who the neediest are. And the reality is in that our system, all of our various service providers do not have a consistent tool that they're using. So if I took several agencies and they all looked at and assessed the same set of people, they would all come up with different ideas as to who was the most chronically homeless and who was the most needy. So the idea was get those folks housed, and when you do that, what you will do is save substantial resources because they're already consuming resources as they cycle, you know, through our 911 system, through our emergency rooms, through our hospitals, through our jails, back out on the streets, and you know, repeat, recycle, and, you know, redo, right? That's how it works.
Right, and that was a big part of the Orlando study, looking at the cost in their state to be able to house someone versus keep them on the street. $31,000 to keep them on the street, you know, maybe, you know, a third to a quarter of that if you're going to be able to house them.
Right. And so the idea, so part of this idea about knowing who the homeless are isn't just for those people who are chronically homeless. It's for everyone. So what we've done in our community is voluntarily, we have been working over the last year or so to align ourselves with some things that are going on at the national level. And we are really fortunate because we've been able to participate and bring trainers out here. And, you know, Larry, I aloha Larry's comments. You know, Colin needs more resources, great. But, you know, Colin has resources, and he's got a brain, and he's got some friends, and he's got the ability to make some things happen. So what we decided we would do is we would participate in being involved in this process, and it was called a rapid rehousing process. And we brought the national trainers who are involved with that here, and in fact, they're coming here again next week. We've got national trainers from the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness, as well as Beth Sandor, who is from Community Solutions. She initially was with the 100,000 Homes campaign, and that has now turned into a national strategy that is supported by the Veterans Administration and HUD.
And she'll be here with us next Tuesday. But as you talk about all of this and rapidly rehousing, you got to have the housing in which to rapidly house someone.
You do.
And that the housing first has been a bit thwarted by the fact that, you know, the city lost the ability to have those properties turn into money in which to put back into some housing that would go into those who are most needy. How do you keep this going with those numbers of people that you say are most needy, and we got to get them off the street first?
I think what people are looking for is a systemic approach that focuses on evidence and results. And I can build that system, or we can build that system. It's not just me. It's a whole bunch of folks involved with the work that we're doing. We can build that system. And then when you start to, I think what you will see is that businesses and third parties who may not be involved now will see that this is a rational approach, that it actually will work, and that together we can create something that does not now exist. And I think, again, I don't want to give the impression that we're not, you know, that our service providers and our agencies aren't doing all they can. They are. But the reality is that we've got to create a much more systemic approach to this. Understand who the homeless people are. Begin to start to triage them based upon the score that they receive. And we have a tool that we're using, which is a national tool. It's called the...
As you look for that, Colin, because our time is running
sure.
a little bit short, I just wanted to ask you again about... All of this is wonderful as it's coming on, but when you get the person ready to go into housing, where are you going to put them?
Well, we have part of what's happened with the, at least with respect to the chronically homeless, is we were fortunate in that we received the Housing First grant. this year again from the legislature. So that's going to assist. We also were aware that the city, that the city administration is still pushing for money for Housing First. But I can tell you that that is sort of the background, because what's really going on is we're creating a systemic approach. And that systemic approach, I think, is really how we're successful in terms of making change happen.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment. We will talk to you on another occasion. Thanks very much for being willing to come in this morning.
All right. Aloha.
Colin Kippen is the state's homelessness coordinator. He oversees the governor's plan to end homelessness. And by profession, he's a lawyer, urban planner, and has worked as a prosecutor, defense attorney, civil attorney, and tribal judge in Washington State. He was also the senior counsel to the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs under the committee chair, Daniel Inouye.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:16. Later in the show, an artist who's made more than one trip back from the brink. But first, your quiz.
If you studied U.S. history, you probably remember the Underground Railroad, but it's less likely you've heard of the Undersea Railroad. On today's date in 1977, two former University of Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology employees, Kenneth Levasseur and Stephen Sipman, released two dolphins from a marine lab at Kualoa Basin. The dolphins were longtime research subjects, and both had been captured years earlier. The dolphins were subjects in a language and communication study and were held in concrete seawater tanks measuring about 50 feet in diameter and only about 5 feet deep. According to Levasseur, the dolphins were highly stressed and often acted erratically when experiments were being conducted. And that's why he and Sipman decided to set the dolphins free. Early on the morning of May 29, 1977, the men removed the dolphins from their tanks, placed them in a padded transport van, and drove them to the west side of Oahu, where they released them into the waters near Yokohama Bay. A calling card purposefully left behind at the lab identified the group responsible as the Undersea Railroad. The men were eventually charged with theft, and criminal trials ensued. For today's quiz, we'd like to know if you can tell us the names of the two dolphins that got their freedom. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, or you can stay tuned for the answer a little later in the show.
Good morning, I'm Karen Meyer from Manoa Valley Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Rosa Dare is a Hawaii Island artist whose commitment to her craft can be measured by what she's gone through to create it. Twice in her career, she's fought back from the kind of debilitating physical injury that could easily have taken it all away from her. Her passion to make herself well again is reflected in her work, some of which will be on display next week on Maui at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Schaefer International Gallery. She joins us by phone from her studio. Good morning, Rose. Rose, are you there?
I am indeed.
There you are. Okay.
Yes.
You know, I looked at your work before I read your story on your website, and before I the story in a way made things come full circle in terms of the intensity that I saw in the work. But tell me a little bit about the journey that you've had to get to where you are today.
Well, I've always had an absolute love and passion for art. It wasn't until the first time I was disabled that I realized how important it was in my life. And at that point, went to art college, did my degree, and then kind of fell back into a comfort zone with art, being a graphic designer. Then a train came along and smashed me up pretty good. I got disabled twice in my life.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, I found myself on and off of bed rest for about 3 years. And honestly, all I could do was stare at the wall, have friends flip books for me. I even tried drawing with pencil tape to my finger. It was a bit hilarious, that part of it, just to watch. But with that came this absolute desire to understand what I was seeing, and more so people. I've always loved stories and storytelling. And being disabled, I noticed that there were a different set of rules of how people would interact with me or what they thought I could or could not do. And then I noticed labels and the stigma that other people went through, and it fascinated me and also really frustrated me. And I wanted to tell people stories and let people see a different way of living and to show that it's beautiful and it's noble and it's empowering.
Rose, when you talk about labels, you're talking about the labels that people attach to disability?
To disability, to say somebody who's a goth person, another person who's perhaps a burlesque dancer, another person who's a shaman Rastafarian.
People who are different, and the way we isolate ourselves and people who are different, right?
Mm-hmm. And we are all one. Once we read the stories, we realize just how similar we actually are to one another.
You know, Rosa, and when I'm thinking about this, the period between the first disability incident and the second one, when you said you'd reached a comfort zone.
Yes.
And it's also easy for those of us whose ability to create depends on some physical ability to take that for granted. Do you think you had moved a little in that direction?
I did. I absolutely did. I moved away from art, and I moved into a place where I was making really good money, but I wasn't doing anything that was satisfying my soul.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really creating anything that could move a person. And what I'm doing now, I just had this beautiful autistic man come up to me and tell me he can't read people's emotions. But one of the paintings he was actually able to read that they were in love. And he gave me this huge hug and cried on my shoulder because it was, for him, the first time he was actually able to see an emotion. And so I think art can be amazingly powerful and healing in so many ways for so many people.
When you talk about somebody with autism, you frequently hear a phrase like differently abled as opposed to disabled with a condition like autism, because clearly he had a perception, a very clear perception that didn't depend on standard pathways to the mind, yeah?
And oftentimes we find people who are autistic or differently abled, they're brilliant. They're amazing, especially in a few chosen areas that they pour their passion into.
Mm-hmm. Well, your passion expresses itself in a number of different ways, but has a sort of a basic in classic use of materials. You're a student of gambling oils, the use of gold leaf in your work, what you call old world techniques.
Yes, I was trained as a classical artist. I consider myself an evocative artist, which is taking that classical sense and really pushing the emotions behind it, invoking a movement or a feeling. And I love the old classic style, but I find when I go to museums and galleries, oftentimes we see a limited range of people in those paintings. And what I'm trying to do is broaden what we see in paintings, especially classical.
I'm just looking at some of the work that you've done that about portraits of other artists, including Buffy St. Marie. That's an interesting one.
Oh, she is so amazing and powerful. She was one of the first people that honored me with allowing her to paint. And she has this amazing history. She was blacklisted in the 60s. You couldn't get her music, you couldn't see her on TV, and that was because of her involvement and her beliefs about Native American rights. And later on, strangely enough, Sesame Street was the one who put her back on TV. She became a regular.
Well, she's certainly a very popular folk artist of that era, mm-hmm. 60s era.
And I try to do a range. She's in her 70s, and then I have somebody all the way in their early 20s. And what I try to do is represent the range of humanity. And so you'll get people from all walks of life, very diverse backgrounds and culture and passion. And that's the one thing I love to do, is really find the passion and the nobility of that person and show it to everybody else.
You also have a taste in your portraits for artists who might be called, well, who are, you know, have struggled with being called different themselves, right? What you might call fringe artists.
Yes, fringe is a great word. They actually started out as my friends. These are people that clawed their way out of the box, got kicked out of the box, or just were never in that proverbial box.
Mm-hmm.
And they're amazing how they've gracefully fought to show a different way of living. And, yeah.
Well, that's very consistent with
stories about these people.
That's very consistent with what you do as well, Rose. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Rose Adair is one of three artists whose work will be on display at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Schaefer International Gallery in Kahului from June 7th to July 27th. And you can get details at hpr2.org.
How the Snowden deal went down, along with the U.S. Constitution.
The documents reveal an NSA that say radically different things in private, that there should be no place where you can go and communicate free of the NSA's intrusive eye.
Glenn Greenwald on the public trust, why Edward Snowden came to him, and why we can never go back to our old assumptions about privacy. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More station members are choosing sustaining membership as their preferred method of support. Thanks to Jacqueline Walden of Honolulu, Sandra Scaff-Kalama of Kaneohe, and Krish Stefanelli of Honolulu for helping HPR to plan for the future. Sustaining membership is an easy installment program of $5 or more per month, and it continues until you tell us to stop. To find out more, contact your membership team at 955-8821, or you can visit the support page at hpr2.org. Good government groups like it, but the governor has serious doubts about the bill to add 15 state boards and commissions to the list of those requiring the financial disclosure of their members. One of those doubts is whether the bill would be worse for women. One woman was in the governor's office yesterday. Civil Beat editor Patty Epler joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
From the conversation that you had with the governor yesterday, did he really understand this bill as far as you knew?
No, actually, that was what was, I think, most surprising about our interview was he clearly had no real idea what this bill was about or what was in it, despite the fact that it's been the subject of many news stories, editorials, TV news reports. I'm sure you've probably talked about it on your show, but he seemed to not know anything at all about it.
Aside from being a surprise, given the fact that it's sitting there and there's been so much discussion about it. What about the fact that the information that he talked to you about was, in some cases, just simply wrong? Were you able to have a substantive discussion with him yesterday?
Well, we posted the entire audio from that segment of the interview on our website so people can actually, you know, listen to it there. It runs about probably 6-7 minutes on this particular subject. I think that Governor Abercrombie clearly is impressed with all the people in the state who volunteer to be on boards and commissions. There's, I think, 1,000 people, he said, on hundreds of boards and commissions. What he was not, I think, realizing was that this particular legislation really only goes to 15 boards and commissions that are very high-profile, really serious financial interest type boards, the Public Utilities Commission, for instance, the Board of Land and Natural Resources. So it's a little bit different than all those folks who volunteer to sit on other kinds of boards, you know.
He also asked you whether this bill was written just for the regions and even asked you the question, is that what it was?
He didn't get that. He didn't realize that this was a bill that was much broader than just the Board of Regents. And in fact, that's been in the news a lot lately, right? That one of the regents has said, I'll quit if the governor signs this. But he didn't even quite get that. I think one of the things was that we were surprised about was that he seemed to think that this bill would somehow disproportionately affect women on boards.
Yeah, and which is sort of where we started to enter into this conversation. How did you correct that?
There's no correcting that in the conversation.
No, I'm saying as he was saying that to you, did you flat out tell them, well, not exactly true, Governor?
Well, we did. We did point out that this was a financial disclosure bill that would require disclosure of people's business interests, not their personal relationships, as he characterized it, who's married to whose second cousin. That's not what this bill is about.
And Patty, one final question, because we got to go in just a second. The fact that he didn't know as much as you thought he should have about this particular bill, did you find yourself leveraging the question into what other bills might not know as much about as perhaps he should?
Well, we did ask him about other bills as well, and he did not know what those bills were about either. It's just that we focused on this one because it's been so much in the news and is such an important measure for the state.
All right, Patty, we'll leave it there. We'll talk to you tomorrow. A bit troubling to hear some of that report, but we'll talk more tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Beth Ann.
Thank you. Patty Epler is the editor of CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Michael Morehouse from the Kahala Hotel. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square talking about foster care.
Well, May is Foster Care Month, among other designations. And you may remember that we talked with Susan Chandler, the director of the College of Social Sciences Public Policy Center at earlier this month. We're going to have a fuller discussion that we hope everyone will call and participate in, because this issue is one that's sort of been riding under the radar a little bit. And yet we heard about the lawsuit last December where, you know, some caregivers had said simply they weren't getting enough money to be able to care for the children in their charge.
A lot more people affected than one might realize, yeah?
More people affected, and also more parts to the story that we really haven't been able to talk about in drips and drabs as we focused on certain parts of it. And we'll have a fuller discussion tonight. Susan Chandler will come back to be with us. Also, Judith Wilhoit, the family advocate for It Takes an Ohana of Family Programs Hawaii, and also the foster home developer at Halekipa, Tanya Williams, will be here. And you too, call us.
All right, tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Beth.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Fertility Institute of Hawaii, committed to building families through fertility solutions, serving Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island. Learn more at 545-2800.
Feel this way too. There's no way that Social Security will be there for you when you're eligible. Max Richmond would tell you to calm down and look at the facts. The CEO of the privately funded National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says those facts tell a different story about the safety net for Americans. He's in Honolulu this week to talk about why that bottom floor support needs to be supported, and he joins us now. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
For several years now, we've heard that Social Security is dealing with a gap, that what's coming in from all of us who pay into FICA isn't going to be able to support those of us who will need it once we get to that point. Earlier this year, the projection was that there will be a little over 860,000 paid in benefits, and the collection to do that will only be somewhere around $770 billion. But then again, there's all the income that's happening on that over time, which is where you say we should be looking, and not just at some of the, you know, here's the income and here's the outgo, but looking at a different type of projection for it. Let's talk a little bit about that, because it's not just a matter of older Americans who depend on Social Security. There are, you know, kids who have lost their parents and others who depend on it for disability and for assistance.
Well, I'm so glad you framed it that way, because most people don't realize that Social Security is insurance for families. Yes, it's for retirees once they reach qualifying age, but it's a program that takes care of families. I'm talking about survivors, disabled, children. You know, there are almost 4 million children, as you know, in America that get by because Social Security is there for them because they have a parent who died or became disabled, and they have protection. You know, we all know the term FICA, but not many people know what that stands for. It's Federal Insurance Contribution Act, and it funds the old age survivor and disability programs. So it's a wide range of programs and beneficiaries that have to be protected. And what we have seen, to comment on your first point, is so many myths about Social Security have been thrown around for years. It's broke, it's bankrupt, it won't be there. That's just not true. The facts tell a different story. The trustees of Social Security issue a report every year. It'll probably come out in a couple of weeks. And the program, the last report, and I don't think it'll be much different when it comes out in 2 or 3 weeks, the trustees tell us this program is sound, is able to pay everybody every penny that they're entitled to for the next 21 years.
And
at that point, there is a shortfall, and it's a significant shortfall. It's about 20%, the difference between what folks should be receiving and what they will be receiving.
In other words, maybe 77, 78, maybe 80 cents on the dollar.
That's right. And we need to deal with that. But two things are important to keep in mind. We don't need to deal with it in an atmosphere of crisis because it's not happening next year. And we also don't need to deal with it in a context of budget negotiations like we saw the last couple of years in Washington when there were efforts to trade away, to use Social Security as a bargaining chip to get more revenue into our federal government.
But Social Security is external to the budget.
Social Security is completely separate. It's funded by a trust fund. And here's a good way to understand and appreciate the dynamics of the way the program functions. You're right. Last year, because of high unemployment, less money came into the program than was needed to pay full benefits. But guess what? Everybody got all their benefits. Why? Because as you pointed out, there is this money is invested. The money that has been accumulated into the Social Security Trust Fund to the tune of $2.7 trillion, that money earns interest. So even though less money came in to the program through the FICA tax than was needed to pay full benefits were paid because the interest on the bonds that are held by the government and that in that trust fund not only brought in enough revenue to pay full benefits, but the size of the surplus grew. So it's a program that does have some issues, long-range issues, that need to be dealt with. And
So let's talk about how to deal with them, because that seems to be what is in the minds of a lot of people who are in their 30s or 40s and thinking, okay, yeah, I have to pay this now. I wish I didn't have to. I don't really feel good about doing this because I don't really feel that it may be there in the future. If you just talk to people, that seems to be at least part of what you say, you know, might be more mythologized than based in reality. So what happens to be able to make up that gap? I mean, Congress is going to have to do something. What do you see
Absolutely.
As being viable?
Well, first of all, those people in their 30s, what I would say to them, first of all, it is going to be there if appropriate action is taken. Second of all, it's there right now in the event that something bad happens in a family. Most people don't appreciate the benefits of Social Security as insurance, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, until something bad happens in a family.
But we should say that it's sort of like the bottom floor insurance. This is not meant to cover anyone's needs 100%, although there are many retirees who are living at the very lowest end of the scale who are using this to be able to literally
survive. But for example, if you are a 27-year-old worker with a spouse and two children, you have right now, never mind about what happens when you're 65 or 67, you have right now $500,000 in value combined life and disability insurance. So it's there right now. Now, second of all, you raised, I think, the key question. What do we do about the long term? I think we need to bring more revenue into the program. Right now, there's a cap on wages subject to the payroll tax. It goes up a little bit every year, but right now it's $117,300. If you earn above that, you're not paying any Social Security tax. Any FICA tax. Is that fair? There are ways to bring revenue into the program by adjusting that payroll cap, raising it. Some would eliminate it. There's legislation in Washington by members of Congress that would raise that cap over time, maybe keep it at the current level and start again at 250 or 300. There are ways to bring more revenue into the program. In fact, One of the key pieces of legislation that we have endorsed has been sponsored by Senator Tom Harkin and Senator Schatz here in Hawaii, and it would do just that. It would bring more revenue into the program. It would raise that minimum benefit by about $70 a month. That's not a lot, but if you're barely getting by, $70 a month is important. And it would change the way the cost of living adjustment is measured so that the COLA, the measure of inflation, is more accurate and seniors on Social Security keep up with inflation. Their checks keep up with inflation. So Senator Harkin, Senator Schatz, and a few other members, Senator Begich in Alaska, they're pushing this. And it's not going to pass this year, but I'm confident that there'll be enough support in the next Congress that we can get some movement on improving the program, bringing more money, and improving benefits.
We have just a little time left, but much of the substance of the conversation that we've just had, particularly about the legislation, has been the subject of conversations that we've had on this program for years now, looking at what happens with this cap. And it seems to come back, well, it's not going to happen this year, but perhaps next year. Some would be very optimistic and say you keep hammering at a wall and the wall's going to fall down. Do you really think that we're going to see that happen in this next Congress? Is there going to be so much difference? I mean, we've got an election coming up. Is that a false hope?
I don't think so. You know why? We have for years, I think, taken a defensive posture to dealing with Social Security. We've been fighting. Remember President Bush privatize Social Security. Thank God we didn't do that. But we spent years fighting that. We have spent the last few years fighting reducing the cost of living adjustment. We're now embarking on a campaign. We call it Boost Social Security Now. And it's time to take an offensive posture and improve the program, improve the benefits, and make it sound even beyond 21 years.
I wish we had more time. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
Max Richmond is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He is also the board chair of the group's Political Action Committee. The nonpartisan committee endorses candidates for federal office based on stands on social policy legislation, which impacts our aging population. He's in Hawaii this week to talk about all of that and also to announce why they think Senator Brian Schatz should keep his job.
Plus one equals light work. The greater the number of members, the lesser the burden on each individual member. In an act of enlightened self-interest, we invite you to join us for the Plus One New Member campaign. Here's how. Recruit just one person to become a new member of HPR, then come to the Plus One Pauhana recording party on Friday, May 30th in the Atherton studio. Find more information on the support page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we focused on what some refer to as the Undersea Railroad. You've likely heard of the Underground Railroad from studying history, so imagine a similar concept, but for dolphins. On today's date, in 1977, two former University of Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology employees, Kenneth Levasseur and Stephen Sipman, released two dolphins from the Kualo Basin Marine Lab. According to Levasseur, the dolphins were highly stressed and often acted erratically when experiments were conducted. Earlier in the morning, on May the 29th, the men removed the dolphins from their tanks, placed them in a transport van, drove them to Yokohama Bay, and set them free. A note left behind at the lab identified the group responsible as the Undersea Railroad.
And today we wanted to know if you could tell us the names of the two dolphins released by Levasseur and Sipman in 1977. And two people called us. Both had correct names. John from Honolulu was in college and said he remembered the headlines, and he got the answer correct with Kea. Ron from Kailua got the other half of the answer. He remembered Puka because he used to swim with the dolphins, cleaning their tanks. And somewhere we hope out there, Puka and Kea are hopefully still enjoying their freedom. Now at 8:50, that's the answer to today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Folk music is music by the people and for the people, traditionally the voice of social engagement in America. Pete Seeger, Leadbelly, and Woody Guthrie were part of an ongoing tradition of artists who use their music as a force for good. Gordon Freitas is firmly in that tradition. He's one of the performers at the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii's 8th Annual Peace on Earth concert tomorrow night. He's with us in CR7 this morning. Good morning, Gordon.
Ki aloha kakahiaka.
I hope you don't mind the comparison to Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly. And
yeah, I'm sure I'm going to end up looking like that one day.
But it's important to you to have your music be about something, isn't it?
Probably more so. It's really important for me to say something with the songs. It's just very important.
And with songs that you've written as well as the songs that you choose to perform, yeah?
Right. I write a lot of songs that I like to tell people. They say, what inspires you? And I said, you know, reading a newspaper, watching the news, watching people, seeing what's going on in the world and what people are feeling and connecting to emotionally, you know?
Sure.
Things like that. And that's usually cause for me to write a song about something. The other day I started writing a song called Let Them Think They Thought About It First, because a lot of people think, man, nobody cares about my ideas, you know, so, and they just shoot them down. So I said, well, let them think they thought about it first. And next thing you know, I'm writing something, you know, so.
So it's kind of a direct pathway for you to have a sort of a little insight like that and say, let me make a song out of it.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I take after my people that I assign now. I had no mentors to say or influences without naming any. I couldn't name any. So now if I name them, I name people like Peter Oppo and Keith Haugen.
Sure.
Who do exactly that same thing. So when you say tradition, that's exactly right. It's exactly what I think I do by default. You know, it's what I like to do. And kind of fell in that category and recently did that concert up here at the Atherton Theater with Haugen and Oppo, and that was awesome.
You guys came on the show and played This Land Is Your Land, and I really thought it was a lovely moment. It was beautiful.
It was great because Keith had talked me into doing something at UH once, and it was one of those events where they celebrated Pete Seeger's birthday. I don't know, it was the 85th or 86th or something, but mm-hmm. It was a while back, and so we're still doing it, you know?
Well, there aren't that many musicians anymore who identify themselves as folk musicians.
Folk is the four-letter kiss of death word for a musician. I think...
But you embrace it.
Well, I embrace it because I think the other musicians have become really chicken poop, you know, for not for not embracing the word folk or Americana. Interesting, you know, being Hawaiian, Portuguese, with Chinese, Japanese, Irish, all that stuff. People look at me and say, that's not an Americana guy, but hey, I spent...
what could be more American?
Hey, I did 21 years in the Navy, came out as a Hawaiian chief, so there. That's Americana.
Before we run out of time, Gordon, let's have you give us a little sample of a song you're going to be doing tomorrow night.
Okay, let's go. Well, we hope to see folks down there at the Hawaii Theater. It starts about 7 o'clock.
So. Yeah.
Put your hands together for the world. Let us pray tomorrow will be brighter. We don't need a mushroom cloud blocking rainbows in the sky, and it's not hard to analyze if you open up your eyes. Put your hands together for the world. Patience is the key to understanding. Let's accept each other's differences for what they may be worth. Peace is all our conscience is demanding. Peace is all our conscience is demanding. Put your hands together. We don't have to be apart. Let your conscience be your guide and listen to your heart. Peace on earth tonight, unite us one and all. History reminds us that divided worlds will fall. Put your hands together, what a joyful noise. Music is the heart to our solution. Put your hands together, you gotta make a conscious choice, you and your kidney. Put your hands together for the world. Put your hands together for the world.
Terrific, Gordon. That's one of your originals, yeah?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I met a guy named Alan White a while back that told me, just start playing your own stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm doing that as much as I can.
Well, and don't ever be ashamed to call yourself a folk musician, right?
That's right. I'm telling people don't, because as the solo artists, you know, that's what they do. In fact, at the concert, you know, you got Led Kaapana and Mike Kaava. You got Keith Haugen.
Yeah.
And of course, the Carmen Haugen Quartet with Frank Uehara and I think Ron Miyashiro. But the sounds of Aloha Chorus people and Stanton Haugen and his smooth jazz sextet. All these guys, in my opinion, are folk. the music of the people.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You know, that's
well, Gordon, we got to run. Thanks very much for coming.
Hey, just remember, one out of every seven people suffer from some form of kidney disease. Thank you so much.
Gordon Freitas will perform tomorrow night at the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii's annual Peace on Earth concert at the Hawaii Theater, and details are at hpr2.org.
More Americana to take us out. That's going to do it for our show today. On tomorrow's agenda, we'll talk about disruptive forces driving a human services revolution. Susan Dreyfus, president of the Alliance for Children and Families, will be with us.
And all the Shakespeare you can handle in the shortest possible time at Castle Performing Arts Center.
Talk back to the radio, our radio to us, specifically on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. You can tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want to tweet me and I'll tweet back, that's at BKOZHPR. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of the conversation.